to fight the virus that has that specific spike protein on it. For more information, visit vaccine.gov or call 311.
This message is a public service of KKFI.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Terry. Jaws of Justice host David Bell speaks with Laura Mars of Key Point Counseling Services, LLC, a mental health and counseling practice established in 1992. They're going to ask the question, are sex offenders victims themselves? And how do we stop the cycle? Their discussion will center on sex offenders, their family, and the treatment for both. How should these individuals be treated, not only by the criminal justice system, but generally in our society as well? When we open the dialogue, you might be repelled at the topic and choose not to listen. That's understandable. Nevertheless, sex offense is a chronic problem in our society, and we can only change the problem if we shine a light on the issue in order to understand it. Sex is a good thing. It does not have to be offensive. We believe we can do a better job, particularly if we examine ourselves for ingrained stereotypes and continue the work toward a fair society. On Jaws of Justice, we investigate how to achieve justice in America. Justice will not be served until those who are unaffected are as outraged as those who are. Now, our show.
Good morning. You're listening to Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI. This is David Bell. Today, we're going to talk about a very hot button issue, and that is sex offenders. Sex offenders, their family, and the treatment for both. And the reason it's such a hot button issue is because on the one hand, some of the behaviors are so awful, they bring about kind of a collective rage that we want to do something with some finality to sex offenders. On the other hand, a lot of sex offenders come from situations and backgrounds where they themselves have been victims. And yet another thread of this is the criminal justice system generally can only speak in terms of probation or prison or number of years in prison. And finally, what we'll talk about today is that many times the offenders themselves are offending against family members who are then coming back and having to decide what to do in terms of recommending punishment. And how should this individual be treated not only on behalf of the criminal justice system, but after their sentence or term of probation is over? To help us untangle all of these issues and get a better understanding, I've asked Laura Mars to be here with us today. Laura, good morning.
Good morning, David.
First, if you could give us a little bit of a background. We know that you're a co-founder and owner of Key Point Counseling Services, LLC, that primarily focuses on the treatment of sex offenders and their families. But if you could give us a brief overview of kind of how you got into this line of business.
Absolutely. You know, I did not expect to be a therapist for 31 years working with sexual offenders. But here I am. It started back in 1990. I got my master's degree and looking for a job. And I got hired at MOXA, the Metropolitan Organization to Counter Sexual Assault in Kansas City. So wonderful beginning to all of this, where I worked with adult survivors of sexual abuse, and I worked with children. And then I also began my work with sexual offenders. And I worked at that point with adolescents and adults. And loved it fairly quickly. And I think when people ask, how come you love it? The most common thing, if somebody says, what do you do for a living? I say, I'm a social worker. And then they say, oh, really? What? And I say, well, I'm a therapist. And then they say, oh, you know, and they name all the things that you might be doing as a therapist. And they say, what's your specialty? And I say, I work with sexual offenders. So almost always the response is, oh, my gosh, I could never do that. How do you do that? And I could say that to any accountant. I could say that to any, for sure, math teacher, which stays in the math realm. Clearly, that's my faulty wet area. But I do not work primarily with men or women who deny. And so that is helpful. They walk in. They know that what they did was horrific. And they want to figure out why. And they want to figure out a new way to live and be involved again and be happy. And so that is really that's the background for me and how I got into it. Didn't expect it, but here I am. You know, David, one of the things that we talk about in group is wisdom. And I just this last week, I was talking to all the different groups that I work with. And I facilitate about 10 groups during the week. And there are 7 to 10 men in a group. And my partner, Ebony McNulty, works with the only women's group we have. We don't mix them together. And I asked them, I said, guys, think 2 years before you sexually offended. And I'm going to think 32 years ago. And if somebody had said to us, hey, sex offenders, they should just rot in jail for the rest of their lives. What do you think? And we all might have said, and we all agreed, I guess so. Or, you know, gosh, sex offenders, the worst ever, right? I mean, we shouldn't have them around at all. Always check the registry, right? And we've all said, I guess so. Because until you take the time to look at it and be personally invested and recognize, like you said so beautifully at the beginning, these are human beings. And I think we forget that. So that's really what keeps me keyed in and involved.
Let's talk briefly about just the term itself, sex offenses. There is certainly, in Missouri law as an example, sex offenses are usually described as a touching of a body part, let's say, with a sexual desire. And it would seem that sexual desire, as I understand the term, just personally myself, having some attraction, physical attraction of a sexual nature to somebody is part of an offense, a sex offense, but there also appears to be other aspects of that. For example, in some cases, power is a part of it. In other cases, maybe it's an attempt to connect with someone, at least emotionally, that somebody feels that this person of a different physical age is actually much closer to them emotionally. There seem to be a number of threads in addition to just the sexual component. And I was hoping maybe we could talk some about some of those other threads before we dive into some of the different types of offenses.
Absolutely. So the good distinction. So with all of my clients, there is some sexual component, clearly, and that's why they're in sex offender treatment as opposed to physical assault or things like that, right? So with these clients, almost, I won't say across the board, but 95% easily have a background where they can identify trauma. And we're not talking little tiny, had a rough time walking to school in first grade. This is viewing a father who is a raging alcoholic, hitting their mother. He's 7 years old, isn't sure, is he supposed to be protecting his mother? And if he does, then he gets physically assaulted. Or maybe then the male cousin who is 17 comes over to babysit and the future offender is 12 and is sexually assaulted by the male cousin. He grows up in a home where you do not talk about feelings. You do not talk about traumatic events. So you take it in and you swallow it and you don't talk about it and you don't emote about it. And so you don't end up knowing how to identify emotion or to know how to talk or trust. So when things like that occur, these traumatic events, and you don't do anything with them, you grow up as an adult with all of these beliefs about yourself, about the world, about sex, about power and control, about lack of power and control. And you walk into adulthood with false beliefs, and then you act out on those. So the example I give always, maybe ad nauseum to my clients, is when I was in fourth grade. I'd like to say I was younger. I don't think I was, David. But when I was in fourth grade, I watched a video in class, and it was gold bullions going into the mint, and out came piles of money, printed money. And so I had learned, you know, something about like the dollar is based on the gold standard, or at least it was then. And so I believed that money was actually literally flattened down gold. I'd like you to say to me right now that you also believed that. Did you?
I did not believe that. And by the way, I think by the time I was into things, the gold standard had been done away with.
Yeah. But. Right, right. There's our age difference. Thank you, David.
So, you're welcome.
So my example of that, why I took that to so much, and I think about it so often, is I grew up, I had a mom who was a teacher. My father, was a smart guy and a World War II vet and read the encyclopedia every night. Neither of them ever said to me, "Hey, Laura, by the way, I think you believe that money's flattened down gold and it's not." And so they didn't know I believed it. So I grew up and went into adulthood carrying this as a truth. I didn't think about it anymore because I believed that everybody thought it was a truth. Mm-hmm. So therefore, when I was 30 years old and I was sitting in a social work office at a hospital and my dollar bill was on its last leg and I realized it was not, dissolving into gold. And it hit me and I couldn't believe it. And I looked at the adult in the room and I said, "Oh my gosh, Patty, this is not, dollar bills are not like flattened down gold, right?" And she was like, duh, no, Laura. I couldn't believe it. And so now years have gone by. Actually, I think I believed that money was gold flattened down longer than I have not believed it. So my point with clients is, when they are growing up and they see a father behaving in a way that teaches them, if you hit a woman, that's how you have power. If the way to get attention is by being sexual, though, if you cry, you are weak. All girls will reject you and you're a failure. So, and there's so many negative core beliefs that they carry from childhood into adulthood. The minute we're an adult at 18, we're expected to make all legal choices perfectly. We are to be in healthy relationships and have a job. And these things do not happen if we are believing these negative core beliefs about ourselves that we believe the whole world believes along with us. So they're making decisions about, I want to feel better. So you know when I feel better is when I turn on pornography and there are children or adolescents on there. And they're not judging me like all of my peers do, because again, their belief is the world is judging them. And so they may feel comfortable and can put themselves there and they feel emotionally at that age. That's one example of that.
You know, another explanation that I have heard similarly a little bit is that I wanted that person to feel what I felt. I wanted there almost to be a connection in that way. Which sounds horrific at first when you hear it, but then it seems like we're getting towards there in your explanation as well. There's something they're wanting to connect to a past experience. You go back to or fall back on what you know, I guess, what you're, like, to say comfortable with sounds so crazy, but at the same time, if what I saw was a parent striking another parent and I learned that's what you do, it seems that even though I might know in the back of my mind that just doesn't seem right, but that's what I was taught. I'm trying to understand how do you, that conflict that would surely have to arise at some point. You're making value judgments where there's a hint within that something's not right, but yet you've been taught a certain way. And so you default to that certain way.
Absolutely. So one of the examples we can look at, because it's difficult for us to look at. So somebody's sexually offended and we're supposed to make sense of that. So a lot of times I do use things that are a little bit more common for us to look at and then just take it and then let's now flip the script. So an alcoholic can get very ill from drinking, can vomit, can have to go to the emergency room. Their appearance can change and it can feel horrible after the fact, during the fact sometimes. But it is the comfort level I want to not feel now. We talk about immediate gratification versus long-term gratification. And when we don't feel good and we're not healthy and we haven't learned how to be healthy, we want to feel better now. And so that's a part of that is the reasoning.
So let's talk then about the other factors that may come into play. There's this idea, at least as I've heard it, that there's something like almost a genetic defect, if you will, or some physical problem that manifests itself in these behaviors. Almost someone's broken. And I hear that without much support, because it seems to me, based on my experience, the people that act out are doing so based on what you've indicated, either witnessing prior events, prior trauma, whatever it may be, but it's not this biological component. Have you ever looked at that component as well as these, societal components or nurture components?
Yeah, I'm not incredibly well-versed in that. I attend conferences throughout the year, and that is not a predominant target. We're not researching that and looking that at time. I don't hear a lot about that. Here is an example. I mean, I can think, let me just take a cross section of my groups. So I have a man who was 15 and he was in a gang, an inner city gang, and went to, this was his family. His father had left. His mother was busy with work and trying to support the family. And so he ended up joining a gang in the inner city. And they would go and commit some crimes and get some money. But that was his family. And that's where he received how he could read his self-esteem, acceptance. Really, for the first time, he describes in his life, this is where he got that and received that. So they went to do different robberies and steal cars. And in one of the moments of a robbery, there was a woman there. And one of the young, it could have been a young man or another adolescent, along with my client, decided to tell everyone, let's rape this woman, and started raping her. And he had a moment that he thought, I'm not comfortable with this. However, if I don't, I lose my family. And he was 15. And so he ended up also taking part in the rape. And then a few weeks later, as all of this continues, he saw that people were questioning maybe his level. And again, he had that sense of, I am weak unless I am hurting someone. I am weak if I show emotion, and I'm not wanted. And so he didn't want to lose that. So in another robbery, he raped a woman again and was caught and went into prison for maybe 2 years and then into adult prison. And was in, and recently I worked with him and he graduated. So he was in prison for maybe 40 years. And one of his comments was, I so wish I could talk to that 15-year-old. And we talk a lot about the fact that they wish so much they could, and they want to be the man they wish they'd had in their lives at the time, or the adult they wish they'd had in their lives at the time. So that's him. That's not a defect. It's life circumstances and then therefore choices based on those. We don't mix up. No one in any of my groups misunderstands. They know they are responsible and knew right from wrong. However, there was a reason behind that choice. And that's what we're figuring out. What was that reason behind the choice? And we talk about the childhood pieces as to being the why was I capable of this? And maybe that's where we're talking about when you're talking about defect. They're talking about why was I capable? And they figure it out from their childhood. And then usually, and then they look at the how was I capable, which is the current things, the life stressors, where it then triggers them back to some of those emotions from childhood and some of those negative core beliefs that cause them. If I'm unwanted, then I feel sad and lonely. If I don't want to feel sad and lonely, I can turn on child pornography and feel better. If I don't want to feel weak and worthless, I can assault or take advantage of an adult woman. If I want to feel not judged and accepted, I can be around my granddaughter who does not judge me and laughs with me and accepts me. And I'm attracted to that. And then it turns into, during some of these, into an assault.
But it would seem to me that at the moment of the assault, let's say an adult male, over the age of 40 and a prepubescent child, it would seem that the, just from a societal standpoint, we have these behaviors we're going to talk about, learned, witnessing potentially as when the offender was a child. But at the same time, it would seem to me that that would also be learned by the offender that what I'm about to do is so horrific. Not necessarily in my own family. Maybe I learned some different type of mechanism, but from a societal expectation, it would seem like it would be impossible to live in the United States, as an example, without picking up that what I'm about to do is considered horrific by by so many. And yet, and there's a balancing there of that choice between what I'm about to do and what I feel most comfortable with. And I'm wondering, does that go on? Is there that balancing in the moment, or is it not? And I know that's complicated. We're talking about a million different people with a million different experiences. No one's the same. But I think from a societal standpoint, that's what I see people saying, like, how could you possibly do that to this child? And I'm trying to capture that question, if you will, and present it to you for an answer.
I wish there was a really good answer, good solid, here it is. But when you're working with these men, so many of them will say, "Ah, if I had just known the impact on the victim in my case." They don't call them my victim. They don't want to show ownership any longer. They don't want to take power and control any longer. If you have learned and grown up where you do not identify feelings and thoughts, and you don't talk them through, they are not real and concrete to you until you've worked through them. And they have never worked through them. And so this often, for the first time, they are sharing even their childhood events. They've never shared them before out loud. They know what they did is horrific. They also now know the incredible consequence of making this horrific decision.
Can they ever know and I guess maybe we never know the impact our behaviors have on others fully, but I'm wondering, is there an opportunity, or how close can you get? And surely in your work, and we'll talk about this in the second half of the hour, how do we get offenders to understand the impact? And I guess that applies in any area of our life, frankly, whether I say something mean to you or do something bad to a friend, whatever it is. But in this particular case, how can you fully appreciate the harm?
And I do have other stories that we'll share, I guess, in the second half, David. Yeah. But one of the big things is they will listen to each other. Number one, they hear other victim stories. They also, they've listened to 911 tapes and recordings. I have a therapist that I have worked with who was sexually offended and has come in and talked with them. So they listen to stories. They have the opportunity at times to hear victim stories. We read the victim impact reports to them from court so that they can listen, and we all hear the voice. And they work through empathy exercises. One of them is called Through the Eyes of the Victim, where they are assigned to tell the story of the offense, guessing, but thinking, how might the victim in my case answer that question and tell the story of the offense? And all of it, we should be hearing, and we do. We listen and we hear the voice of the victim in the case and not them. And we all listen in that room. And that's impacting.
It almost sounds, Laura, that if I truly felt it, it would almost be an impossible thing for me to get up afterwards, right? If I'm experiencing or describing it from the eyes of the victim, particularly if I'm an offender, it almost seems an impossibility to get back up and move after that, right?
Often it's quiet after something like that. Most do a phenomenal job. And if they don't, the men hear it and they give feedback, and it's strong. And that is why we do groups. It's not individual work, because, man, they've all been there and they're calling each other out and listening for that empathy and listening for good work and good honesty and transparency.
This is David Bell on 90.1 KKFI Jaws of Justice. Our guest today, Laura Mars from Key Point Counseling Services, LLC. We've been talking about kind of what gives rise to sex offender behavior, and we've just touched upon treatment. And in the second half, we're going to dive more into treatment of sex offenders and their families. You're listening to Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI.
Support for KKFI is provided by the Kansas City Indian Center, serving the community since 1971. Based in Midtown, KC, the Kansas City Indian Center encourages social, educational, and economic advancement of the American Indian community by promoting traditional and cultural values. You can learn more about their programs, events, and resources, and how to support their mission at kcindiancenter.org.
Thanks for listening to KKFI. Be sure to like and follow your community radio station on social media at KKFI 901 FM. And thanks for 30 years of support.
The University of Kansas Alzheimer's Disease Center is recruiting volunteers with and without memory problems for the BioHERMES study, which is working to ensure Alzheimer's assessment tools are sensitive and specific to all. To ensure diverse representation in the study, KUADC is inviting Latinx and African American individuals to participate. Volunteers will receive a free brain scan and information about their brain health to present to their primary care physicians. For more information, visit on the web at kumc.edu/KUADC. This message is a public service of KKFI.
Now the calendar for the week of October 18th. Legal Aid of Western Missouri can provide free civil legal services to low-income and vulnerable people who live in Jackson County, Missouri. Interested individuals can call 816-474-6750 to apply. For Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense virtual meetings this week, go to momsdemandaction.org. All are welcome, mothers and others. The Kansas City Chapter of Missouri Citizens United for the Rehabilitation of Errants has a monthly virtual meeting. Missouri Cure advocates for the human rights of prisoners in Missouri prisons and jails, as well as for those who have returned to society. For information, please call Keith Brownell at 816-377-2873. Monday, October 18th, is Monday Meets at 3 p.m., an online event hosted by the Willow Domestic Violence Center on Facebook Live. Tuesday, October 19th at 6:30 p.m., The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together, is presented by author, strategist, and political commentator Heather McGee and Joni Wickham, who was chief of staff to former Mayor Sly James. Watch the presentation live online at the Kansas City, Missouri Library's YouTube. Thursday, October 21st, Hope and Healing Support Group at the Casey Mothers in Charge office, 3200 Wayne, Suite 124, Kansas City, Missouri. Special guest speaker will be Jackson County Prosecutor Jean Peters Baker. Hashtag stop the violence. Hashtag we will always remember them. A list of services, meals, and hotlines are available at lawrenceprogressivecalendar.blogspot.com. That's updated daily. Thanks to all our listeners. Stay close to your dial and stay well. My name is Terry, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Stan Thomas. We'll now return to our show. Host David Bell speaking with Laura Mars, therapist at Key Point Counseling Center, LLC, and their topic is treatment of sex offenders.
This is Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI. I'm David Bell, and we're here today talking with Laura Mars about the treatment of sex offenders and their families. You know, Laura, one of the things that we talked about during the break was this idea of if growing up I felt powerless, I felt like I had no control over myself and I was victimized, then it would seem that I would want to avoid that dynamic in the future. And I surely wouldn't want to put anybody else through that. And yet that sounds to me like the opposite of what potentially is going on with some of the offenders that you are treating. Could you help me understand that?
Absolutely. And great question. And they have the same, how could I do this? I was hurt here. I hurt someone. They have the same in a different sense, but that same, oh my gosh, can you believe this? Make sense of this. So with that, I would look at, David, I have a client a few years back who discussed he had had several adult rape victims. He had witnessed as a child his father being physically violent towards his mother, horrifically beating his mother to a pulp and just horrible, horrible stories. He witnessed this and as a child felt weak and helpless to be able to stop it. We talked about someone in the first segment about just that weakness as a child, not being able to stop, not being sure if she should or can stop it. And certainly he could not as a child. He grew up then carrying that sense of weakness, sense of powerlessness. He was bullied in school as well. And so when he became an adult, he would describe it at first in treatment as, I was just angry. We know that anger is a secondary emotion. So we walked him through identifying the emotions that trigger that anger. And so it was feeling unwanted, unlikable, unloved, weak, not man enough. And then those beliefs, those negative childhood beliefs that are not true, but we believe them to be true, like the money story, which is men do not cry. Men, if they have feelings, they're weak. All women talk back. And so when he would be triggered by something in the community, in his environment, his anger grew. When he felt low self-esteem, his anger grew. When he felt weak, his anger grew. And he ended up sexually offending, raping adult women. So that's one example of where he was offended as a child and viewed that and watched his mother beaten, hated it, and ended up behaving very, very similar, clearly. And maybe worse behaviors and reactions. I have other clients who grew up and maybe were assaulted as a child sexually and then grew up sexually assaulting a child. And they also are shocked by their behavior, sickened by their behavior. How could I do this? I was scared to death when it was happening. And so with that, it might be, and it's different clients in different cases, obviously, in each situation, but they might take that then into adulthood and feel uncomfortable around peers. And who do they feel comfortable around? A child. And so an example of that that is so, so watered down, and I fear giving these watered down examples because I want to emphasize that I'm very clear on the impact and the horrors of sexual abuse. If I go to a church function and I'm not looking as good as I'd like to look, and I remember going to vacation Bible school to teach one year, and I hadn't had time to get ready and I looked kind of lame. I get there and I was not comfortable to go be around the adults. I went down to the children's area and I was completely myself and having fun with them. So I was more comfortable with a group that I thought would not judge my appearance. Mm-hmm. Now take that 10 fold, right? And you've got the world doesn't like me. I'm uncomfortable in every adult situation, every peer situation. I am a failure and I cannot succeed. Who do I feel most comfortable with? Children. And so I'm around children. I want to feel better with it. And then I groom them. I think that they're attracted to me. And we can look at it now, and they look at it now, and she was 8 years old and I was 45, but she gave me attention. She laughed at my jokes. I believe that she found me attractive and I found her attractive. Now I know at 50 that was incredibly unhealthy and harmful thinking. But I believed it at the time because I had never stopped and thought this stuff through.
When we talk about, as we go and move on to treatment, one of the questions is, and I've heard this asked and answered by politicians is, can a sex offender be cured, if you will? And I think as I say the question, I'm thinking, God, that's an unfair question because of all the problems I've had in my life, whatever they may have been. Could you honestly say I've been cured of anything? But that question is thrown out there. And the answer is once a sex offender, they can't be cured. Danger, we have to isolate. But surely from your standpoint in treatment, I guess cure may be the wrong question to ask. But I'm grasping for something, Laura. What is it?
Right. So we do not use the term cure. They do not use the term cure. What we would say is you acknowledge that you have sexually offended. You acknowledge that you are solely responsible for that offense. And you acknowledge that you need to constantly be revising your relapse prevention plan. How am I never going to have this happen or allow this to happen ever again? And so they have all of that in place and they now know how to go about that. I was reading recently, there was a therapist, a doctor who had worked with sexual offenders for over 30 years. And his comment, and I agree with it, it was something like, we all think they're monsters. And when we find out who they are, we treat them as monsters. And that doesn't help in any way. And I would agree with that. And that is a huge piece of having this not happen again. In a sense, David, I believe we're all in this together. Mm-hmm. We don't realize that. We think you are a sexual offender. Don't ever do it again, but also stay away from me. And also live where we say, which really we don't want you to live anywhere. Certainly not near us. And we're going to tell you what kind of jobs you can have. And maybe you were a chemist before, but now you're going to work in a factory. And maybe if the factory finds out that you're a registered sex offender, possibly you'll lose that job and move on to another one. And so what we're doing there is continuing the isolation. We're continuing the loneliness, the boredom, the low self-esteem. And we all know where that leads. We've just talked about that.
It almost becomes almost a self-fulfilling prophecy in a way. When we talk about treatment, Laura, it sounds to me like the treatment, the focus is on recognition, or maybe that's wrong, unpacking, if you will, what gave rise to the behavior. And that in turn has us going back in time to what? How would you describe that? I know treatment is a long process. And we only have a few minutes, but what? How would you describe the process of what is treatment of sex offenders?
Really good question. So when we go back to the negative core beliefs from childhood, right? So the very first thing they do, I'll walk quickly through what they do. So they first come in and they tell us their lives. They've already had an evaluation with the therapist. So we know where they've come from. We do some risk assessment tools with them. And they have a probation or parole officer. They're taking polygraph examinations while they're in treatment. To determine and monitor how truthful are they being through their work? How transparent are they becoming? And so we're working with all of this. There's a treatment team working, probation and parole, therapists, family members, the client themselves, the offender themselves. And they start out, they come into group and they share their story, good and bad. Here's where I've been and here's where I am today. And then we talk about their family and the roles that the family had. Then we have them work on some tools to prevent behaving in ways that are going to be harmful in the future. One is called a thought stopper or thought changer. With that, they just think, if I stay in this situation and behave in the way I'm considering behaving, often it's nothing about sex, but it might be if I don't go to work this morning, or if I go down this road and it's one way and I'm going to try to get to that driveway the wrong direction. But sometimes it can be, I'm attracted to that 13-year-old in front of me at Lowe's, but I'm just here to buy the hammer. They think, what's the worst case scenario if I remain in the situation I'm in, or if I behave the way I'm considering? And they consider that. And if they can't live with it, then they move on and they change their thinking at that time and their behavior and their setting. So they learn tools like that. They learn the HALT tool, just different tools. Then they also then identify how the triggers externally and internally that happened around the time of the offense, before the offense and during. They also identify how they groomed themselves, how they groomed the environment, how they groomed the victim or victims in the case. And they identify all of that. So all of this is starting to be a picture and it makes sense. It's putting together a puzzle with them. And then they work on a life drama triangle. That is the one where they're looking birth to 18. And how did they, what did they learn about themselves, about sex, about relationships, about men, about women that are inaccurate, but they learned it to be true and took that in their little suitcase into adulthood. So when you talk about unpacking, that was a really good actual example or analogy, David, I think, because they get into adulthood and they haven't unpacked it. So it's still all bottled up there. And they then do their case report where they talk about, this is what I did. Here are my thoughts, my feelings, and my behaviors. And they walk through it like an autopsy. And they really, with that, are owning each element and each little piece of the offense. Then they work on their sexual autobiography, things like that, identifying different types of sexual fantasies. And then they finally do their sexual offense cycle. And that's where you take it from your negative core beliefs from childhood all the way through to where you did triggers, grooming, choosing who you're going to victimize and why. What's the payoff? You know it's against the law. You know it's going to be harmful. You do it anyway. Why? And they identify that. And then we walk over to the actual sexual offense. And then how did you try to keep it secret? How did you try to pretend normal until you were caught? And they walk through all of that. And then at that point, they're doing the empathy exercises through the eyes of the victim, which we talked about, an apology letter that's just generalized and kept at the office. And then they work on a relapse prevention plan.
And so what is the hope at the end of this? That when they graduate from your program after, it sounds like it would take at least over a year.
It's usually kind of on average 2 years to actually 3 years.
So what's the goal at the end? You're able to say what, that this person, I don't know, I guess we don't use the term cure. So what is it we're saying about the person?
This person knows what they did. They own it. They do not give any responsibility to anyone else for it. They understand what triggered them, what can trigger them in the future, what they did to groom themselves, what they could do in the future to get on the bad track again. They have a good support system and they identify that. They know who to call, who they should call, who they should be around, who they should not be around, what they should stay away from, what they can be around. And so that's a big piece. David, here's a great example, I think, of someone who successfully completed a sexual offender treatment program and was in the community. And then also community's response that worked out pretty well. So this is years ago. I had a friend who lived in a subdivision around Kansas City in a suburb. And they called me and they said, oh, my gosh, Laura, the HOA, their homeowners association, let them know that there was a sex offender, a registered sex offender residing in their subdivision. And they were just bowled over. And so I said, well, and I looked up his name and I could see somehow I could determine that I thought probably he had been through treatment. He had not been a client of mine. And so I said, you know what? If this client has been through treatment, he should be able to handle them approaching him and asking questions. And so we talk about that all the time in group. And so they did. They went to him and said, we're alarmed here. His response was, I respect you approaching me. I understand that you're concerned about my sexual offense. Let me tell you, I have been through treatment. I know what to watch for. And let me reassure you, I have a son and I have a wife, both of whom have come into my life post-offense, so after my offense. I want my child to have a good childhood, and I want him to enjoy living in a subdivision, a safe subdivision. I have a wife who I want her to enjoy her life with her son and with her husband. So she will take him out on Halloween. I will not. I will turn the lights off on Halloween, and I will stay inside. But my child is going to go trick-or-treating. There's a neighborhood pool. I'm not going to go to it, but my kid is, and my wife is going to take him. And we're going to live here, and we're going to enjoy our life. But I'm going to answer any questions you have for me in the future. And you can approach me anytime as long as it's with respect, because I own what I did and I know it was not right. They did not expect that kind of response. And of which I think, David, many men who have been through treatment would respond in that like. Interestingly, I drove to my friend's house around that time when she first had told me, and she didn't even have to tell me where he lived. I could tell. The front yard of his home was like a forest of trees. It was so incongruent to a front yard in a subdivision. And I thought, that's where he must live. And I asked her and she said, yeah, that is. Slowly through the years, and I would drive to her home here and there, and I would drive by his home and slowly trees would be gone. And now when I have driven by in the last few years, it looks like a regular landscaped subdivision yard.
Wow. That is a wonderful story. And it made me think, as you were going through this and going through the treatment of it, I wonder how much it would help if, as a society, we were to start on the proactive approach and run everyone through a program like this before anybody is offended, in order to unpack. Maybe that is what therapy is supposed to do, but it seems like there would almost be a benefit to this unpacking of a variety of human experiences that some of us have had, some of us haven't, from 0 to 18, and deal with them early before they're buried down and they reemerge in some offense that may or may not be subject to criminal sanctions.
Wouldn't that be wonderful and so smart? You're exactly right. We just have to remind all of us to share with each other, to be as non-judgmental as we can be, and be a space of safety, to listen, to not be silent partners in the community when we see something that doesn't sound right, doesn't look right, to go ahead and speak up, so that we're not enabling things to continue. And one way that that we can stop being silent partners would be to allow second chances, as long as the work is being done to allow our community to be safer.
You know, speaking of second chances, I know that you do work with families of offenders, and it would seem that and a lot of times the offenses, at least the people that I've dealt with, it's people that they knew. It's this stranger danger is, I guess, happens, but it seems to happen, at least anecdotally from my experience, it's a much more rare event than with individuals that are known to the offender. But when you deal with family members and you're dealing with them helping out, maybe helping the offender in terms of his or her treatment, I would have to imagine there's a feeling of guilt, particularly with parents of offenders, or a feeling that they've failed, or a feeling of them accepting responsibility. All of that intertwined. How do you deal with that?
Oh, great point and great question. So we offer something. It's part of the state and federal treatment that we provide. Also a sponsors program for families or friends or coworkers or church members or pastors who want to, who have said to an offender, I will be your approved sponsor. And so they have to go through a program, and we call it the sponsors program, and they attend it. It's a 6 to 9 hour program where you're working on, first of all, hearing the offense, hearing the details of the offense, and the offender or the client shares their case report that they wrote that has all of the details, their thoughts, their feelings, and then their offending behavior throughout the entire thing. So their pre-sponsor, before they've been approved, has to hear that, read through it, ask questions, and say they believe it and they know that the offender is solely responsible for this offense. At that time, then they go through this program. They learn the different pieces of thinking errors, grooming, triggers, relapse prevention, safety plans. They learn all of this. They also learn the stipulations, which are often, I am not to be alone with any minor for any reason, not even for a split second. So if you're asking and saying that you will be my approved sponsor, you along with me are ensuring that I am never alone, even for a split second, with a minor. That would be an example. If they want to go to a family reunion, the sponsor is saying, I will attend it with you and be with you at all times. If I want to attend church, there's maybe a safety plan made with the church and a plan in place. And so we are making their world larger, their environment larger, and their opportunities to be a part of the world larger.
You know, talking about that safety plan real quick brings me back to, I guess, what we started off with as we come to the close. We have a few more minutes left. But this idea that they could never be in the same room with a minor ever for any reason, it seems to support the idea that there's some almost involuntary reaction on the part of sex offenders, that if a child walks by, they're just going to snatch him and run, which is a false narrative. And I think Absolutely. very harmful for both to how society views sex offenders, but also to sex offenders themselves. So how do you answer something like that? Is that more of a protective shell, if you will, for the rest of society versus the sex offender himself?
Correct. For some offenders, certainly it's a good piece to have in place, but not for the majority. It's not a necessity for the majority, but it is for reassurance to the community. It's reassurance to the probation and parole that they're on at the time. That's a big piece of that. And then later, safety plans can be individualized to the situation that people are in. And so if you have a child and you're a sexual offender and you have a newborn, you're going to work it out where you can be with your newborn if there's no issues. My client that we talked about earlier that maybe would have been a teenager when they committed their offense, we're not concerned according to all of the risk assessments that are done, according to all of the polygraphs that are done. I mean, none of this is done just, you know, lightly and without a lot of thought and without a lot of involvement of a lot of voices. And so from that, they will determine what is a safe environment for me in the community and what is where I need to have some things put in place.
Final question, Laura. In terms of judging success of programs like yours, it seems to me that I would want to know the recidivism rate. Individuals that successfully complete the program, less likely, more likely. How does that compare perhaps to other crimes? If you could give me a little insight into that as a kind of a final question here.
Yeah, thank you, David. We know research has shown for years recidivism rate among sexual offending is not high. It is one of the lower recidivism rates. If you have completed treatment for sexual offense, it even lowers the rate even more. So we know that from studies and research.
Laura, I appreciate you being here. I think for our next show, what I would ask, if possible, is that you can see if an offender, sex offender, who has been through your treatment and is willing to come on, would be willing to join you on the show to talk about his experiences and to talk about what happened early on in his life. Maybe the offense itself briefly, the treatment, and where he is today. I think that would be just an unbelievably helpful show and very would bring a lot of insight to me and to our listeners.
I agree, David. That would be really, really interesting and enlightening, I think, for listeners and for all of us. I have several men who would love the opportunity, and I will certainly look forward to that.
Laura, thank you again. This is Jaws of Justice on 90.1 KKFI.
I am Izel Robinson, Minnesota inmate number 210006, an innocent man confined within the quadrilaterals of systemic injustice, fighting to be heard and effect positive change. Yet to accomplish success, I need you, the listeners, to hear me and act. So I am only asking if I can be heard and count on you to act. Today I want to share an opinion piece called Blind Consequences, the Unjust Effects of Conditional Release, that I recently wrote. America's states have recently seen a push in efforts to eliminate systemic injustice and revise criminal justice. Recently here in Minnesota, the Minnesota Department of Corrections has introduced a bill called MRRA, Minnesota Rehabilitation and Reinvestment Act. The MRRA bill appears to be an idea to begin an incentive program where inmates can possibly get early release based on different positive programs successfully participated in or completed while confined or while on parole outside of confinement. Yes, this initiative appears to be a good start at the revision of criminal justice in Minnesota. However, that is only on the surface. A concern is the incentive program will not be open to all inmates, particularly those deemed to have committed a violent crime. Change like this should be inclusive of all and not limited to systemic opinion of who should be eligible for an opportunity for change, especially if corrections and the premise of this bill is truly about rehabilitation. Now, my main focus is MRRA's exclusion being a blind consequence similar to the unjust effects of conditional release, which will continue to restrict opportunities from inmates labeled as sex offenders. Often when citizens on the outside hear the word sex offenders, combined with sex offenders being released into community, a level of hysteria arises. However, that hysteria is unwarranted here in Minnesota, where about 80% of convicted sex offenders are mandated to participate in and complete sex offender treatment while confined or on parole. The treatment programs focus on accepting accountability, recognition of harm ripple effect, recognizing problematic thinking and replacing it with healthy alternatives of thought and action, making amends and behavior changes, building healthy supportive networks, and challenging oneself to be a law-abiding, productive part of one's community through employment and empathetic service. Plus, research has held that sex offenders who participate in or complete a treatment program while confined have a 10% chance of returning to prison after release for a new sex offense, and a 25% chance of returning on a non-sex offense-related crime or violation. Due to what I've highlighted, I don't think inmates with sex crimes should be denied access to the MRRA incentive program in Minnesota if they have proven they're successfully participating in or have completed sex offender treatment and other programs. More importantly, I think in order for MRRA to be practical, fair, and effective, Minnesota legislators must get rid of conditional release and make the incentive eligibility available to all offenders. The conditional release is a blind consequence placed only on sex offenders and DWI offenders for a 10 years or lifetime period. It is a consequence that isn't listed in the maximum time an offender can be sentenced to based off felony points in the Minnesota sentencing guidelines. An offender is usually sentenced to their allowed time to serve under the Minnesota sentencing guideline, then this extra 10 years or lifetime conditional release is added, which amounts to an extended parole after an offender's original sentence has been completed. In some cases, this becomes an actual life sentence that an offender was covertly sentenced to. However, in fairness and transparency, if Minnesota wanted to sentence an offender to life, they should have met the sentencing guidelines to do that and not implemented the secretive enhancement. This enhancement has unfairly led to the reincarceration of offenders at high rates based on technical violations, which are often the makeup of rules that aren't actual crimes or criminal behavior. These offenders have been held in prison for several years under the conditional release after completing their sentencing guidelines maximum for violations like having a smartphone without the agent's permission or entering an establishment that serves alcohol. Although they're 21 years or older, didn't buy alcohol, and in fact, alcohol isn't illegal. Beyond that, conditional release places barriers on voting rights, government-subsidized housing, and employment, further suppressing true citizenship and community rehabilitation. Conditional release is an injustice and real problem in Minnesota that needs to be exposed and addressed in a healthy way to foster needed dialogue and support.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
Here in my problem, what am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it some way, somehow? Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcast on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, send email inquiries and comments to kkfi.org/contact. This is Terry, reminding you that our outro music is Better Man from the Plain for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9, followed by Understanding Israel-Palestine at 9:30 on Fridays. Up next is Link's Mix with Mixmaster Link, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for jazz and blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en...
Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet. Hear from regional and national guests fine to create a healthier future for our community and the planet. Hear from regional and national guests, find out about upcoming events, and learn how to keep yourself and your family.